This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Carrie Knowles knew she wanted to be a writer from a young age, and she made her dream a reality. She's been writing for decades and published two novels, a novella, dozens of short stories, hundreds of newspaper and magazine articles. She was the 2014 North Carolina Piedmont Laureate in short fiction. She has two books coming out later this year. Carrie Knowles joins me now to talk about her passion for writing and where it all began. Carrie, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. What a joy.
It is a career. You're in midstream. You're still going. But I actually want to take you back to a key family story that really shaped your life and also has shaped your forthcoming novel.
The Inevitable Past. Yeah. That's my new novel coming out in May. And it grew out of, I am both a visual artist and a writer, and got invited to be one of seven international artists in Brisbane, Australia. And the curator of the show, the name of the show was The Inevitable Past. And they wanted us to bring together our two sides. We were all dual artists. And so mine was visual and writing. And one day I got a call from the curator and he said, we did the schematic for the galleries and you have a 30-foot wall. And I thought, oh my gosh, what in the world am I going to do with 30 feet? And I sort of dropped back. I'd been doing some art pieces. They were all small. And I thought, that's a lot of art pieces. And I fell back into a story that I have avoided writing all my adult life. And should I tell that story or just
tell
read
that story? Well, tell that story and then I'll have you read. But
okay.
Tell us.
The story is in 1901, 1902, a young woman was found badly beaten and unconscious on a train station platform in Macon, Georgia. And at that time, at the turn of the century, Macon was a hub for 15 different railroads who came in. And the police found her in the morning. She had no wedding ring, no evidence of a wedding ring. She had no purse. She had no ticket. She had no luggage. And she was unconscious. And the police realized she was pregnant and took her to a place called the Door of Hope, which was a home for wayward girls at the time, i.e. women who were unmarried. And a doctor examined her and realized two things. One, that she was pretty far along in her pregnancy, and two, that she was going to die pretty quickly. So they made a decision to do a C-section, an emergency C-section, and the baby was my father. And the woman died, and no one ever claimed the body. And during the C-section, it was an instrument birth, and my father's eyes were damaged, and the woman who was the matron of the Door of Hope, realized that, you know, it was Georgia. Nobody knew this woman. And for all practical purposes, he was a child without a lineage. And that made him difficult to adopt. And the fact that he was blind made him doubly difficult to adopt out. So she made the decision to raise him at the Door of Hope. And her name was Mrs. Knowles. And that's where my name comes from. And we never found out anything about my father's birth mother. But that woman has haunted my brothers and my sister and I all of our lives. Who was that woman and what of her is in me has always been my question. So I fell back into, well, that was my past and what was inevitable about that past. So I sat down and I started writing, and this is the first page that I wrote, and it became the cornerstone of the novel, and it became the piece that then got turned into actually a 27-foot shroud, because the grandmother is speaking from the grave. She's dead. So this is the introduction to The Inevitable Past. I am the grandmother you never knew, the one who vanished, the unsolved crime. I never held your father in my arms, only in my heart, but I was with him every step of his life, as I am with you. I am your blue eyes and your fair skin, a flutter, a thought, a whisper. I use dreams to guide you over the rough spots my life has created for you. My dreams are your dreams. I am part of you. What happened to me the night your father was born has shaped your life. I rest deep in your DNA. I cannot change that. I wish I could. My experiences have made you slow to trust. Shadows make your heart race. I know. But the good of me is in you as well. You are strong because I was strong. You fight back. You speak your mind. You have courage and are curious. You are smart like your father. You are the best of me. It is time for you to know who I was and who you are because of all that happened and why I have come to you. I need your help.
Carrie Knowles, reading from her forthcoming novel, The Inevitable Past, one rooted in your own family history, a history you knew. You always knew that story, right?
I knew that story, but didn't know anything beyond that. Knew a little bit about Mrs. Knowles, but my father didn't talk about her very much.
And you say that you were really shy about it. I mean, you steered away from this story for most of your writing career until now, right?
Right. I mean, because how do you write a story you don't really know? And also, I mean, she really has, it may seem odd, but she really has haunted my dreams. I've thought a lot about her. I think about her all the time and wonder who she was, where she was going, where she came from, what she was doing, what she dreamed about. Never wondered who the father was, but, you know, that's sort of funny.
Well, that's interesting because that did come to you as you siblings were talking about it. Somebody mentioned.
Right. And none of the four of us ever thought, I wonder who our grandfather was. It was always, who was our grandmother?
Where was she going, right? So how did she get to Macon? And of course, you know, what was the story that led up to your father's birth? So tell us a little bit about this title, The Inevitable Past, the idea that in a very physical kind of genetic way, she is, you know, part of your history, haunting your history.
Right.
That past, in a way, this story may be embedded in your DNA because of what we know now about epigenetics.
What we know about epigenetics and the idea that we get our blue eyes, our brown eyes, our curly hair, whatever. But there's also other DNA things that we get that they refer to as not being expressed or being expressed. So we get lots of DNA, and they don't quite understand what the triggers are that this one will be expressed, this one will not be expressed. But they do know that it comes from somewhere. Our fears of things, our joys of things, being born with dreams to do things, to understand things. I always tell people when I lecture about this or talk about this that most of the research has been done on fruit flies, and you can't make a fruit fly happy. So, you know, it's always been sort of centered on trauma. So,
right.
You know, they can see if a trauma happens to a fruit fly that it doesn't visit their children, it visits the next generation. Mm. And so the research is centered on trauma.
That's right. And that trauma can trigger these rapid genetic changes that would happen much more quickly than, you know, sort of slowly getting a longer neck to reach the higher leaves or that sort of thing. Things happen very quickly as a result of trauma and can be then part of the genetic code expressed more readily. So this is fascinating. You revisit the story. What was it like for you to actually start taking on the story that you had avoided all these years?
I had to do a lot of research. I had to figure out what was going on for women in that time. I actually moved the story back to 1893 to the Chicago World's Fair because I wanted a place where two historic things had happened on the same piece of land. I like location a lot. I like to have real things in all of my stories. And so I took the story to Chicago, the World's Fair, the same piece of land where the World's Fair started, where you entered the World's Fair, is where is Grant Park, where the 1968 riots were during that convention. So the book is written in two parts, the grandmother's story, the granddaughter's story, and the granddaughter becomes involved in the 1968 riots.
Well, let's talk about how you got involved in writing. You're born in Michigan. Talk about your family growing up.
My family growing up. Well, my father was blind, and my father worked for Leader Dogs for the Blind, which was in Rochester, Michigan. And he raised money. He was a public relations person for Leader Dogs, and he went around the country raising money. And he flew everywhere. Obviously, he wasn't driving a car. That would have been sort of bad. Mm-hmm. And so we chose to live by the airport so we could see my dad. He would be gone 2-3 weeks at a time, then fly in, be home for a week or so, and then fly back out. And the town that is close to the airport is in GM, Motor, Ford town. And I would say that the majority of people in Wayne, Michigan, where that was, worked for the auto industry. And so my father was truly an anomaly in town and stood out. He was also a very big man. He was tall. He was a little over 6 feet tall. He had a presence to him. And he was blind. And people, it was, you know, 1954 when we moved to Wayne, Michigan. And, you know, people, I remember one time a neighbor saying, oh, it's really, really bad that your father was shot in the face during the war and he lost his vision. And I looked at this woman and I said, well, that didn't happen. And she said, well, it did. And I said, no, he was born blind. And the woman said, well, nobody is born blind. And I said, well, some people are. And my father was. So, I mean, people just didn't, right. They couldn't put my father together. And so we were the blind man's kids, and we didn't fit so well either. And in order to spend time with my father, we would leave town on May 30th and travel all over the Midwest with my father until September 1st. And so I never spent a summer in the town I grew up in until I was 16 and had a job.
We talked about the fact that you traveled a lot, and on one of those trips, you broke your arm.
Well, not on a trip, but we had just moved to Wayne, Michigan, and my father was out of town, and my mother knew, we didn't know anyone, we didn't know our neighbors. A refrigerator got delivered in a big cardboard box, and our house was right on a hill that went down to a creek, and the older boys in the neighborhood took the box and turned it into a sled on, you know, it was springtime on a grassy sled. And I really wanted to get on that sled, and they didn't. I was, you know, a five-year-old, and they didn't want to do that. So my mother said, just wait, they'll get tired. And they did, and I got on it, and I did what they did. I put my hands behind me to push myself off, and I snapped my elbow in half. And right above the elbow, I snapped my arm in half and, of course, went into the house, and my mother freaked, threw me into the car, and she didn't know anyone. She didn't know where to go, but she knew that driving into town, she had seen a big hospital, and she took me there, and that was Eloise Mental Hospital. And they were quite surprised that my mother brought me there to fix my broken arm, but they said, well, we can do that. So they fixed my arm, and that was a very amazing experience to be in a psychiatric hospital with people wandering the halls and everything going on, and my arm got set, and we got into the car, and my mother turned to me, and she said, don't tell anyone I brought you here, not even your father. And I realized that that was the first time I understood what shame was, and that she had made a mistake, and she didn't want people to know that she had made that mistake.
I mean, on the one hand, perhaps not quite the right hospital, but also this hospital had a reputation, right?
Right.
And that was the
other part. It was the crazy hospital.
It was the crazy hospital. Nobody wanted anything to do with it.
Right.
And in a sense, it was sort of out of the minds of the people who lived in the community.
People pretended like it wasn't there. And it was a huge hospital. At one time, at the very height of it, they had over 40,000 patients. So it was a major mental hospital. It's now a golf course. And a condominium development, but it, you know, at in 1954, at that time, it had its own dairy farm, its own pig farm, it had its own bakery, it had its own post office, it had its own fire department. It was huge. It was actually bigger than our town.
Have you ever stopped to think about how much of your life revolves around institutions that nobody else wants to talk about?
A lot of it. My first book, my first novel, Lillian's Garden, grew out of that experience of the shame people packaged onto, you know, mental health problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about how you became a writer. When did you start getting interested in this?
My family didn't have very much money. And in order to go to school, I had to pay for college on my own, which was possible back in the 1960s, completely possible, not possible now.
Right.
And I worked part-time while I went to Wayne State University, and one of the first jobs I had was with WXYZ Radio in Detroit, and I wrote promotional pieces for them, and then I went on to do other small writing jobs, and I eventually, my last 2 years of college, I wrote for a sports magazine called Competitive Breed. And that was, you know, Michigan, so it was drag cars and speedboats and motorcycles. And I would leave school on Friday afternoon with a mechanic and a photographer and an editor, and I would cover races all over the state of Michigan, and I would do interviews, and I would come home Sunday night, and I would write up all my copy, turn it in Monday morning, and go to school.
Did you have any interest in motorsports at the time?
No, that's why I had the mechanic with me. But it was a good paying job. And
yeah.
I, you know, they were looking for a writer. And when I went to interview, they said, "But you're a girl." And I said, "That's right. Good. I am." You know? And I told them I would write two pieces for them for free. And mm-hmm. if they use them, then they had to hire me.
Did you find that, was that your kind of a challenge? Look, I don't know anything about this, but maybe that's where the gold is, right?
I think writers are curious.
Yeah.
We do a lot of research. We want to know. You're the same way. You know, what's going on? I can do that. I can figure out about motorcycles. I still can't change the oil in my car, but I knew a lot back then. You
can tell somebody else how to do it.
I can tell somebody else how to do it.
Listen, that's a virtue.
Right.
I've claimed that that's a virtue my whole life. I know how to tell you how to do that. Now you talked about going to college, paying your way through, making the money, even, you know, you're writing even to make the money to afford college, but your father didn't think that writing was a good pursuit.
No. In fact, he quit speaking to me for quite a long time. He didn't want me to be a writer. And he wanted me to be a doctor. I did not do that. And we fought about that quite a lot. And his bottom line was he felt that if I became a writer, I would starve to death. And I said, "I don't think so." And he said, "You will. And I'll never rest easy knowing that you're a writer." Then he quit speaking to me, basically.
Did you reconcile? Were you able to
Did
talk
I reconcile?
Before?
No, right before he died, he said... promise me you won't be a writer. And I couldn't promise that.
I suppose the one virtue in it is he did expect you to make your own way and not just marry somebody who would take care of you.
No, he never talked about me, somebody taking care of me. No, it was always, you know, making my own way.
So what did you do when you got out of college? How did you make your own way?
I left college and I worked for a short time for the Detroit News on the first ombudsman column in the country called Contact 10. There were 10 writers, and we were every morning given a stack of problems that we were to solve. What kind of problems? I bought this car from, you know, this dealership, and it's got these problems, and I keep taking it back, and they tell me there's no problems, but every time I try to start it, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, what the Contact 10 people would do, you know, we had a telephone, and we would pick up the phone and say, "Hi, I'm Carrie Knowles from Contact 10, and I have a letter here. Let me read it to you. Let's see if we can solve this problem before I have to write about it."
Oh, wow.
And
that's pretty cool.
Amazingly, things got solved very quickly.
That's pretty cool. That's actually, you know, that example is actually how the parrot sketch was created. That was a reality for Monty Python.
Uh-huh.
A couple of the characters had actually had that very experience with a car that the salesman kept saying there's nothing wrong with it. And it turned into one of the iconic sketches for Monty Python. So there you are. You're in good company. You moved to Chicago eventually.
I did.
Yeah.
I did. Right after college, I was... I went to Breadloaf Writers Conference in Vermont, and William Meredith heard me. I had a fellowship there, and he heard me read some of my work, and he said, "You're really good. It's going to take you a while to make it, but you're really good. What are you doing next?" And my father had just died, and I said, "I don't really know what I'm going to do next." And he said, "I have a friend down in UNC Greensboro." And I was up in Michigan. I'd never heard of UNC Greensboro. And he got me into UNC Greensboro in a snap. And I was all packed. My car was packed and I was ready to go. And I had a very bad nightmare that I was being trapped in a jar. And I decided not to go. And I woke up that morning and my mother looked at me and said, "You're not going, are you?" And I said, "No." She said, "What are you going to do?" And she said, "Well, you have to call them and tell them." And I said, "I will." So I called them and told them, and then I hung up the phone and she said, "Now what are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to drive to Chicago." and I went to Chicago.
What had you been thinking about Chicago until then?
No, I just, there was something, I just made a snap decision that I was going to go to Chicago. And for a short time, I waitressed, kind of got my feet financially on the ground, and then I started freelancing again, and then freelanced and did some teaching and did a lot of freelance.
So you're doing a lot of work in journalism, right? You're doing feature pieces, ombudsman for a newspaper. Had you been this whole time sort of imagining yourself as a novelist?
No, I think I actually started the most publishing I did, which is not true. I published some short stories and some other pieces, but I was publishing primarily poetry initially, which made me a very good headline writer. And it really did. And yeah. I often tell people, you know, find a job and, you know, do commercial work because you'll learn. I mean, if you have to write raised hearth fireplaces 75 different ways and to make it beautiful and enticing and wonderful, you learn an awful lot about writing. It was kind of my graduate school for writing was doing commercial work. And you make a lot of money doing commercial work, and why not? And it really gets your feet solid on the ground, and you know, if you're a poet, you make good headlines, and I don't know.
You also, while you were at Wayne State, you did have, it was either a major or a minor in psychology?
Took a minor in psychology, yeah. And then I went on, because I found it fascinating, I went on to get a master's degree in social psychology, and I actually also worked on my doctorate, but never did the dissertation.
So now you're in Chicago. What kind of freelance? Are you taking kind of anything you can get, or are you beginning to specialize?
Anything I could get, and lots of different things. Articles. I was always publishing poetry and short stories at the same time. No novels, because that was, you know, I had too much concentration. I didn't have that type of time. I was a book reviewer for the American Library Association for a number of years. And so I read, you know, I would get a stack of books and I would read them all, write the reviews, take them in, get another stack of books, read them all, write the reviews, take them in. So I did a lot of book reviewing as well.
What about that work or the academic work you did in psychology? Do you find that you have applied that?
Was absolutely. That useful to you? You know, you learn a lot in psychology to look at the world, to think about why is that person doing this or why is that institution doing that? How do these pieces fit together? And so it makes it easy to think about writing a novel.
What brought you to Raleigh?
My husband. You know, my husband, I met my husband in Chicago, and he took a job with NC State, and we moved down here. And that was in 1978, and Raleigh was a very different town than it is mm-hmm. now. And for a while, I often wondered what I had done wrong in another life.
Difficult transition for
it was a difficult transition. Yeah. It wasn't difficult coming to the South because my father was from Macon, Georgia. Mm. And we were in many ways raised Southern in the North. So it felt very comfortable to me. Culturally, it felt tremendously comfortable for me. But it was a bit jagged going from Chicago to Raleigh. And for about 6 months, I flew back and forth and kept my job with the American Library Association and eventually had to let it go because it was just too much.
Well, what about
jumping on a plane?
Rest of your writing career? Eventually, you had three kids and you're moving to Raleigh. So is this affecting your creative life at all?
I think it opened some doors for me. There were things to do here that were different that maybe I couldn't have done in Chicago. When I had the kids one morning, I realized that Thursday used to be the day in the papers where there would be all these recipes and things. And one morning I was sitting at breakfast and thinking about this, and I thought, there are women around here that this is the only thing they read, that the only thing they have, they might as well read good articles. And so I started writing food pieces, and I I wrote for three or four different publications, some magazines, and I wrote food articles, and I wrote about culture and food and history and food, and I did some work for Better Homes and Gardens, and It was just great fun. Eventually, I became the restaurant reviewer for the News and Observer.
So it did open, as you say, some possibilities for you. What about the time constraints or not in terms of your creative work and being able to write and also, you know, having three kids, a husband?
That's complicated.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. And, you know, one of the more complicated issues was that many of the editors in New York or other publications I was working on, I don't think they woke up until 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
If at all.
And so, you know, people would call. And I also did a lot of radio work. I did a lot of commercial. I wrote and directed radio commercials, which I absolutely adored. And then, you know, clients and editors loved to call at 3:30, 3:45, 4 o'clock, 4:30. And that drove the kids crazy. And also, I found myself the day bleeding over into my parenting day. And at one point, the kids had a little powwow and said, when you're cooking dinner and stirring the spaghetti and doing whatever, you're not with us. You are someplace else.
How old were the kids when they did that?
They were probably, you know, 12, 8, and 5.
Wow.
And they said, you can't do that to us. And so my office was at our home for a long time. And I had to learn to shut it off. I had to learn to stop and pay attention. I also write a column now for Psychology Today. They didn't know I had a psych degree. They didn't care. They just liked my writing. That was a funny experience. And they let me write about anything I want to write about. And actually, the next piece that I'm going to put up this, going to submit this week, has to do with that paying attention, you know, being present. I frame it in the terms of I'm sort of in semi-retirement where I get up and I go swim every morning. And then instead of working from 9 to 5 in my office, I now work from 10 to 6. So it's not exactly
ten to 4,
yeah,
I would suggest.
Well, yeah, so I'm trying that. But it feels very wicked, very wicked. And I was swimming the other day and I looked up and I realized that the lifeguard wasn't doing anything but watching a swim.
Yeah.
And they weren't, you know, the lifeguards weren't reading books, they weren't texting, they were just, and I loved that idea. And what the kids wanted from me also at that point was they wanted me to be a lifeguard. They wanted me to not be doing anything else and just focusing on them.
But in that moment, at that intervention, when they all looked you in the eye and said that, you're thinking, I'm a good mom, up until that. And then were you able to accept that right? How long did it take you to realize, oh, my God, they're right?
Oh, about 5 minutes.
Okay.
You know, I knew they were right.
I mean, they were
serious,
that's
for
sure.
They were serious, and I knew they were right.
But, yeah, that's interesting.
I knew they were right because it's hard to turn off. You know, if you have a character in your head who is talking to you, or you have an editor who's screaming at you, one or the other, you know, it's very complicated. You know, if you have an editor who's asking you to do things, or if you have a character who's talking to you, and I often tell people when I teach writing courses, if you're not hearing voices, do something else,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
you because your characters do get into your head. It's hard to turn them off. And so you wind up, you don't look like you're multitasking, but you're not there.
I wonder, do you, because I've always thought this is true, you know, that writers are really in touch with that side of their brain that has this conversation that isn't in English. And then they're feeling all and understanding these things, the arguments they have with their characters and all these things you hear. And the brilliance of the writer is not only to be in touch with that, but also then to translate it into a language that we can all understand. But then the question is, based on what you said, do you lose anything if you say, you've got to go back to your room. I'm going to finish this meal and then we can talk. Or do you gain something by paying better attention to them when they need you and better attention to your child?
I think you do gain something, but I think it's hard. It's like, you know, will they come back? It's like, you know, if you all of a sudden you have a brilliant line in the middle of the night and you don't get up and you write it down, is it lost?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes it's lost, but I think that you have to turn it off or you're never present.
Your husband took a sabbatical when your kids were young and the family moved to France, and that was an important experience for you.
Tell us about that. And that's where a garden wall in Provence came from. I had an assignment to do a series of 5 articles about food and life in France, and it was fascinating, sort of we had this tiny, we had a very nice townhouse, and we had a kitchen that this table that we're sitting at is twice as big as the kitchen I had. And I had a little under-the-counter refrigerator that looked a lot like the dorm refrigerator that we remembered. And I had two burners on my stove. And but in Avignon at that time, and still today, you do have those small refrigerators going on in Europe. You shopped every day. And that was the part of the rhythm of your day. I walked the kids to school, and then I went shopping. And then I bought only what I needed for that day, because that's all that would fit in the refrigerator. And I did the same thing the next day. And it was wonderful. I mean, that sort of connected rhythm of what we were going to eat, what I was going to do, things that I was going to create for our meal was so grounding. Big grocery stores really, in that sort of shopping where you overflow the cart and then you come home and you shove it all in the refrigerator and you don't know what's in there. I would love to live in a situation again where I just had that little half refrigerator.
You also took a trip to Australia, one that your son didn't particularly care for initially.
Initially, no, because he was in high school. He was leaving middle school, going to high school. And in Australia, the school year is January through December, not, you know, because of their summers flip-flop from ours, or ours is flip-flop from theirs. And he just thought we were ruining his life, and we probably were, but he adjusted to it and had a great time, but it was a rough going. And we actually have lived in Australia twice, which has been fun. Beautiful country, and very sad to, you know, we keep in touch with friends there, and to know how much destruction has happened has really been
difficult.
Awful.
Going. What's it like for? Is it helpful for a writer to be displaced periodically, do you think?
Oh, I think it's a good thing to go, to get out of your comfort zone every day if you can.
Yeah.
This is out of my comfort zone, so here we are.
Good. You know? We can stay here for another hour because we're loving
it. Sure. Yeah, we're having a good time. No, I think it's very good. I think for anyone, whether you're a writer or not a writer, to venture into a different country. I mean, think of how big this country is. It's really four countries, you know, and people who've never left the East Coast and never traveled to the Midwest are missing something. If you've never traveled out west, you're missing something. You're missing a different way of looking at the land and thinking about the world.
You wrote a book based on your own experience, nonfiction, a kind of memoir, The Last Childhood, Family Story of Alzheimer's. Talk about that book and the way that came about.
My mother had Alzheimer's, and my siblings came to me and said, this was back in 2000, so now 20 years ago, and they said, look, this is really hard. And we've read all these books, but none of the books talk about what it's doing to us. And so the book is really centered on the impact of Alzheimer's on the family unit. What does it mean for the family? And the title, The Last Childhood, comes from the fact that on average, Alzheimer's is from onset to death is 17 years, which is a childhood.
Yeah.
And so that's a long time. And if you're caretaking for that amount of time, that's a long time. And the first 5 or 6 years are these kind of horrible shadow years where you really don't know what's going on, but something's going on, but you don't want to pay attention to it because if you do, then you're responsible for it. And so there's a lot of family tension where one sibling may say, I think something's wrong with mom. And the other one says, mom is fine. And then you have the stupid little brother who keeps saying, mom is fine. And you have the older sister who's saying something's wrong. So, you know, there's a lot of family dynamics that get bumped on really badly by the Alzheimer's situation, not to mention the financial impact on the family.
Your family did, while going through all that, seem to navigate it pretty well.
We made a lot of mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to credit and be, you know, always credit my siblings, my two brothers and my sister, who were so willing to share the things that we did and to, you know, disclose mistakes we made and how hard it was for us and just the day-to-day decisions we had to make and that they were willing to have me expose them. And they came to me and said, you're the writer, fix this, please.
I mean, you don't want to sum it up, but if you had some advice for people who are going through this or families who are trying to navigate this, I mean, what's a way to approach this?
It's very, well, we had, I think it worked best for us. My sister was the point person. She was the one who kind of took the lead on it, and we were the support people for her. And I think that the absolute most important thing is you have to maintain communication with your siblings and with your whole family, that you can't let past hurts or mom liked you better, or, you know, you got the car, or whatever the deal is, you have to let that go. And you have to be able to work as a team, as a unit, because it's just too much for one person to bear.
I would think one of the hard things, too, in any situation like that, where, you know, the family is trying to figure out what's best for an individual who's now can't take care of themselves. If the decision doesn't go your way, you thought it should be X, and we've
right.
done Y, and now things are not turning out well. It's sort of staying with the team and saying, well, okay, look, we all signed on to this decision, and even though I thought it might turn out this way, I can't really keep bringing that up.
Well, the good news is things never go well with Alzheimer's. So, you know, somebody, it's just going to, it's a downhill road. I think that there's two very, very, very hard decisions. One of them is the car. And I say, get rid of take the car away.
Yeah.
That's the hardest thing. You've got to agree to that. You have to do it. And the next thing is, if your parent or your spouse or your sibling develops Alzheimer's in such a way that you cannot care for them at home, you don't have the resources at home to do it, and you have to make the decision to move them to a care unit, that's a really tough decision for all of you to come to and to be comfortable with. The problem is that when that decision is made and the move is made, I can put money on the table and guarantee that the person with Alzheimer's, once you make that move, will appear to be better. And the reason they appear to be better is because they're in a very controlled environment. You may think they have a controlled environment at your house, but they don't. The doorbell rings, the mail gets delivered, the dog barks, whatever. The kids come home from school. And so although family members have come to this really tough decision, they all agree, mom or dad, we're moving them to someplace else. Then all of a sudden that first week, that second week happens, and they appear to be better. They know who you are. They are actually, they have a little bit better memory. And at that point, you know, it's like, see, I told you we didn't need to do this, but you did. And that's tough. That's a really tough thing.
You talked about the fact that you were Nobel, the Piedmont Laureate in short fiction in 2014, and that involves a lot of teaching, right? Going around.
It was wonderful.
Talk about that, because you like to teach.
I love to teach. Not all the time, but I do love to teach. And any of the Piedmont Laureates would tell you the same thing. It's a great program, and I wish it was all over the state. And in the program, they offer in the community, through the arts councils, they offer, the laureates offer programming. They offer writing courses. They offer, you know, things about plays. David McConey just did a spectacular job with the, you know, music, bringing, you know, talking about music, having musicians come. These workshops, if you hold a workshop as a laureate, they're always filled, completely filled. And one of the things that struck me about the program was how many people wanted a chance to have a voice and to just try one time, just a little bit, dipping their toe into the water of being a writer, and how excited they were by it. And I thought, I would like to write a book that brings writing to people who do not have the background that we would think, well, you weren't an English major, you don't have a college degree, you're not this, you're not that, you know, that it's, you're enough who you are.
And
so that's what I did.
That's the book. It's coming out soon. Talk
it
about
is.
That book.
It has a long title.
It's a long title.
It has a long title. It's called A Self-Guided Workbook and Gentle Tour on Learning How to Write from Start to Finish. And it is, I break it down and try to present very short lessons and try to make them not be pedantic or not be, to feel comfortable, to feel like, I could do that. I could do that. So one of the lessons that one of the classes is about point of view. Now, if I were in a teaching the class and said, not today, we're going to talk about point of view, most people would glaze over, zone out, right, thinking, I cannot do that. That is too hard. What is she talking about now? And so I talk about the Thanksgiving table and how, because that's a meal in the United States that everybody shares. And it's usually families, and everybody comes to grandmother's house or mother's house or your sister's house, wherever it is. And you all think you are at the same Thanksgiving table, but you are not, because you bring your point of view to that table. You bring your past experiences to that table. You bring your childhood to that table. And that table becomes, for many people, a war zone. But, you know, it's, and that's what point of view is. It's what in the character's past are they bringing with them to look at the world, you know? And it's a fun exercise to talk about the stuffing in the turkey.
Yeah. Well, so how do you do that? Because again, I think people often would come to you if they want to write. As you said earlier, they want to express something. They have something they want to say, and they want you to give them maybe the technique or the permission to write this. So here I am talking about what I want to say, and now here's you saying, but what you're going to have to do if you really want to do this as a fiction anyway is get into somebody else's head, right?
Or know whose head you're getting into. So I will never be a main character or even a secondary character in any of my stories or books, because I would like to be taller, thinner, smarter, and a lot wealthier. And I could never be all those things. But I can bring my past experiences to that experience, to that writing situation. And so I want people to understand that they can get out of their own skin and they can bring their experiences, they can bring what they want to say, and they could give it a different set of clothing.
What are some of the other barriers that you've encountered that clearly are getting in the way of somebody who's, they showed up, they're at your workshop, they want something?
Right? Many people who came to those workshops wanted to tell their life story. They wanted to tell this particular story. And a lot of times I encourage people to move nonfiction to fiction, because there's more truth in fiction than there is in nonfiction. Nonfiction is this happened, that happened, the next thing happened, the next thing happened. But the emotional truth of what that experience was and how that impacted the lives around it, that's the story. That's the story. And the problem, so a lot of times people who are writing for the first time, who, you know, want to tell the story, they get hung up on the story. This happened, then that happened. And I'll come in and I'll poke a hole in it and I'll say, well, what about, how did this make you feel? And it's very hard for people, if they're writing nonfiction, to tell the truth about how it felt. And I'm more interested in how something feels and how something impacts people than they had Cheerios for breakfast.
Yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in that. The real barrier is that you're not telling the truth about yourself. You're trying to conceal rather than reveal, but maybe.
Because I'm really not 5'10", and I'm really not 110, you know?
Well, and you think you want to tell your story, but again, you can't bear to express the emotions. So,
right.
But if it were another character, if it were somebody else, we could easily, perhaps more easily, tell you how they felt about things.
Right. Well, and there's a lot of barriers to telling the truth. There's your mother in your head saying, you're not going to say that, are you? You know, there are a lot of voices in your own head stopping you from saying what you really want to say.
You write for Psychology Today, as we said,
I do.
Among the many other things that you do. Talk about some of the what's interesting you lately. What are you writing about?
Oh, I love it. What a gift. You know, they came to me and decided that they wanted sort of to begin to present a different point of view with their columns, and they wanted a non-psychologist, and I laughed, and I said, I said, really? And then they said, we want you to, they had read a bunch of my work, and they said, we really love the way you write, and we want to just turn you loose, and you can write about anything. And I said, so define anything for me, you know, because that's a big door. And I really get to write about anything. This week, it'll be about lifeguarding. The last one, I'm trying to think, there's so many of them.
Well, let me stop you there, because the lifeguarding is what we made. You're making reference to an earlier part of this conversation where you noticed that lifeguards, at least in your pool, are not on social media and they're not doing anything else but guarding your life. That kind of attention, and of course, we're living in a world where we're so utterly distracted, and I wonder what you think about that and kind of the impact that's having on us, because we seem to be able to do it, but it's, I don't know that it's without effect.
You know, I've written about how important it is to just be still, you know, and they're personal. They wanted them to be personal. They're personal. They have a little story to them. You know, I've written about just how difficult it is to be without that telephone, to be without that iPhone or whatever droid or whatever you use. And so I've started to make myself, like I did today, I show up earlier and I'm not allowed to touch my phone. I just have to sit there and see what happens.
Well done. Well, what happened was, I think, a really wonderful hour, but I still have enough time to ask you. And I know you've got two books coming out, so maybe this is not the time to ask you. What's next?
What's next? More columns for Psychology Today and maybe some more short stories.
We didn't even talk about your short fiction.
No. Oh. No. And Black Tie Optional is 17 of my short stories. They're not all of my stories, but they're all stories that have to do with women having to take a role and to discover something new about themselves. And 6 of those short stories were honored by Glimmer Train, which no longer exists, sadly. But I'm very proud of that. And they were, too. They were quite excited about the collection coming out. They called me once and said that I had been honored more than any other writer that they had dealt with. So that was lovely. But I love short fiction. Short fiction is a very hard, every word has to fit. And it's all about somebody discovering something and changing a point of view, changing how they see the world. And I love that idea of discovering something and discovering something about yourself and also about the world.
Carrie Knowles has told us something about herself and I think about the world. She's an author of several books and a columnist for Psychology Today, the 2014 North Carolina Piedmont Laureate in Short Fiction. Carrie, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Are we done? How sad.
For now, but we'll have you back.
That'll be wonderful.